It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll learn about when personality changes can be normal, a part of aging, and when they can be hints, early signs of dementia or Alzheimer's.
But first, we're continuing our week-long Aging Wisconsin series. The nation's aging population is creating job opportunities. The move to keep older people in their own homes as long as possible means work for people who have what it takes to do a tough job for not a lot of money. Our series continues with this report from Patty Murray.
Home health care workers go into an older or disabled person's home to help them with tasks that range from the mundane, like shoe tying, to the intimate, like baths and going to the toilet. It's work that Shelley Waltman enjoys.
It's not like a job over there. They accepted me really fast, and I mean, it was a really good match. They brought me in. It's just kind of like having another family out there.
Waltman is a certified home health provider who works through NEW Curative, a nonprofit based in Green Bay. Four mornings each week, she works with a couple in their 70s.
I wouldn't call them elderly, but aging.
The husband has Alzheimer's disease. She gets him cleaned up and dressed and monitors his medication. Waltman has done the work for years and says it takes patience and compassion.
You know, one minute, you know, sweet as a lamb. The next minute, you know, some of these debilitating, you know, things that get people. It's sad because you just, you know, one minute again, like a lamb, and the next minute you can be getting hit. So, yeah, you have to be willing to take the tough with the good.
Caregivers like Waltman may be hired by family members who need a break, or they could be the client's main source of help. They can work through private companies or places like NEW Curative. All in-home caregivers need some level of certification. Green Bay's Northeast Wisconsin Technical College graduates 700 certified nursing assistants each year. Students can also get a short personal care worker certification. Cindy Face is the school's associate dean in the health sciences department. She says the work is rewarding, but nursing assistants deal with people when they're not at their best.
You know, you can't curl up your nose if something does not smell pretty, because that's what's going to happen. And just even the ability to touch other people. There's people who are very uncomfortable being touched, and there's people who are very uncomfortable touching others, but you will have to be touching people. You're going to be helping them bathe. You're going to be doing those activities of daily living, obviously, that they can't do themselves.
NWTC claims an 85% to 90% placement rate for its healthcare graduates. Starting jobs pay between $10 and $12 an hour. For those who aren't pursuing a higher degree of nursing, home health care seems to be more of a lifestyle than a career. Shelley Waltman, the in-home provider, says it's easy to get attached to clients, even those who are rather difficult.
Watching somebody fail, knowing that some types of the things they're going through, you know, will progress. Just seeing how hard of a time, you know, the family has with it, and being able to empathize, because I did have a grandma who, you know, had issues like that, and that's the hard part.
Waltman says it is the hardest part. Patty Murray, Wisconsin Public Radio.
That was the third installment in our week-long series on aging and elder care in Wisconsin. Tomorrow at this time, we'll learn about how different cultures deal with elder care.
After Los Angeles Clippers owner Donald Sterling made headlines for some very controversial remarks, his wife told media outlets she worried his behavior might be because he was suffering from dementia.
To be clear, no doctors have diagnosed Sterling with any cognitive disorders, but the situation has sparked a national conversation about aging and the early signs of dementia and Alzheimer's disease.
And we want to hear from you on this topic. Has someone in your life been diagnosed with dementia or Alzheimer's? Did you see early warning signs, or do you worry that a family member or loved one is exhibiting signs, behavior changes, and wondering, is that related to some kind of dementia-related disorder? Call in and share your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email at talk at WPR.org.
We have two guests from the Alzheimer's Association with us to talk about some of the first signs of dementia and Alzheimer's and how to tell age-related symptoms from general changes. Carrie Patterson is the executive director for the Alzheimer's Association South Central Wisconsin chapter, and Kathleen Albert is the community outreach specialist with the Alzheimer's Association Greater Wisconsin chapter. Carrie, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Kathleen, it's good to have you too.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, Carrie, we're going to start with you. Let's talk about some of the earliest signs of dementia or Alzheimer's. What should we be looking for?
Sure, yeah. The most common changes are usually related to those early memory loss experiences or recent memory loss. So that could be what happened the day previous or maybe even things earlier in the day. As Alzheimer's or a dementia starts to happen in the brain, mental fatigue and frustration can take over, and so some people might have some experiences with those most recent memory loss. When it starts to impact your daily living, your day-to-day habits, your appointments professionally and personally, we do start to get interested if there could be a dementia process happening.
And
but it's not always, it's not always memory loss. There can be some other complications and mood and behavior changes.
And how can we tell the difference between, you know, what happens to everybody saying, you know, I put my keys down, where are they, and what is actually perhaps a symptom of Alzheimer's or dementia?
Sure. Well, I think most cognitively healthy adults are able to sequence and backtrack their processing. So, for example, if you're coming in from your vehicle parked in your driveway and can't find your keys, maybe you'll be able to sequence back and figure out if you came in through your garage or your front door. Where more people with dementia or an Alzheimer's type of a dementia, they might have more challenges figuring out where the keys might have ended up. Are they in their purse? Are they in the bathroom? Did they put them in a consistent location? So they just have challenges with those processes.
And Kathleen, if you see a family member who looks like they might be struggling, I mean, it's a sensitive thing and it's not news that anybody wants to think about, but what should you do?
I think you hit the nail right on the head. It is very sensitive and, you know, it's a very private and a personal thing, and it's very difficult to approach that. And depending on your relationship, I believe honesty is the best policy, to sit someone down in a quiet environment, you know, one-on-one with them, and just express your concerns. Never use the words, I've noticed you're having problems with your memory, or any of those types of things, because people tend to be on the defense if you do that. Use, you know, I'm concerned about your health. I've noticed you're not feeling as well as you used to. I've noticed some changes in your health. And then ask them, you know, have you noticed anything? So get their input as well.
Okay.
It's a place to start.
It's a good place to start. And mm-hmm. what kind of treatment is available? Let's say you go to the doctor, Carrie, and maybe it seems as though there is some early Alzheimer's, early dementia going on. What happens next?
Sure. Well, we have several different memory diagnostic centers in the state of Wisconsin available for families to use as a wonderful resource. They also can work with their private physician, internal medicine physician, to really see maybe they haven't had a quality health exam or a full review outside of maybe a pressing issue, a minor cold or complication, something like that. Maybe it's time to dig a little deeper. Sometimes it can be as minor as a vitamin deficiency or a medication adjustment. However, when it is really something that needs to be looked at more in depth, there are memory diagnostic clinics certainly available that we can help with our 24/7 helpline service, help route people to the appropriate location nearest their community. What happens in those reviews is a family member might attend an appointment with the concerned individual. Oftentimes, families can help expedite the process and send some notifications to physicians that I'm sure Kathleen will be able to share some great techniques on that a little bit later. The physician will do a full medical and neurological exam, see if they have any balance issues, maybe it's a hearing loss that's impacting their response and socialization. We can also challenge people's memory objectively. There's many different tests that people can take, so it's not just a family report saying their behaviors are different, but we can actually see performance issues on neuropsychological exams in these memory diagnostic clinics. Family will interview with a social worker or other team member from a clinic and really provide a history of what's now changed over the recent year or so that's really flagging this appointment. You know, maybe they were very detail-oriented and some of the checkbooks might seem to be a little off, or maybe they were always very good about sending birthday cards or tracking seasonal changes with some social calendars. And maybe they're having more confusion with time or place or all these different minor details in their lives. The physicians will use that social information, the objective information from those memory tests, and really perform a very detailed interview with that particular individual. Sometimes they might need more. They might need more brain imaging. MRIs can be very common. We can see structural changes in the brain. The actual volume of the brain does change. This is a disease, and not a lot of people know that. A lot of people think this is just part of the aging process, which it is not.
We're talking right now about the early signs of dementia and Alzheimer's and what families can do and kind of what happens in the diagnostic process right now, talking about how to tell the difference maybe between normal age-related behavioral changes and Alzheimer's and dementia-related changes. We've got two guests with us from the Alzheimer's Association. And we're taking your calls next. Has someone in your life been diagnosed with dementia or Alzheimer's? And what were some of the early warning signs? Are you concerned that a family member or a loved one is maybe showing some of the signs that we're hearing about? You can call and share your experiences, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. We're picking up our discussion now on the early symptoms of dementia and Alzheimer's with Carrie Patterson and Kathleen Albert from the Alzheimer's Association. And we're also taking your calls right now. How has this affected your life? Has someone in your life been diagnosed with dementia or Alzheimer's? And what were some of the things that you first noticed? And what did you do about it? What helped as a strategy for coping? You can call us with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to talk@wpr.org. And we're going to go to the phones now and take a caller from Madison. Linda's on the line. Hi, Linda.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing fine, thanks. So what do you think about the topic? What have you noticed?
So first of all, I want to thank you very much for bringing these things up. It's great to share this with other people and hear what other people's issues have been. Mine, one of the first indicators that I had, which I look back at now and see that it was an indicator, was the microwave. Her microwave was showing signs of being burned, of a lot of burned things inside it, and it started to indicate to me that she was not capable of using that anymore. Also, a lot of burned pans and things like that, which it's a great indicator for you know, kids to look at these types of things and say, okay, we might have an issue with mom's safety, you know, and her ability to use the appliances. My mom was, she was tripping a lot. She was losing her equilibrium. And, one of the things that I would love to pass along to people is if you have someone going through dementia, please get rid of their floor carpets, the little throw rugs, because as you start to lose your coordination, those things become really, really deadly. So my mom, she was taking a lot of spills, and I really was questioning what was going on there.
All right. Thanks a lot, Linda. Lots of good points there. And Kathleen, Linda, they're talking about, you know, some of those changes you mentioned. In her case, her mother was not really, you know, behaving the same way she did in the kitchen. Things were getting burned. Is that something to look out for?
Definitely. And I think, you know, I have a personal connection to the disease as well. My mother was diagnosed in the mid-1990s with a form of dementia called Lewy body dementia, and these were definitely the early signs for her, you know, the inability to understand her thermostat in her apartment. It's hot in here. And then I would go, and it would be on 85. She didn't understand the concept of turning it down. The microwave, the clock, inability to read time. So definitely that, you know, inability to cook anymore, the inability to plan a menu or to bake something. You know, those are kind of some of the early signs. And with men, it may be they've always been able to take things apart and put them back together. Losing that and that ability as well may be an early sign.
What about personality changes?
That is a very, that's a good point. And sometimes that is a subtle one, a very subtle. You know, we tend to sort of think as of older individuals as probably becoming grouchy and crotchety as they get older, but that really is not the case. And so if somebody has a drastic personality change, somebody who's very compliant, easy to get along with, suddenly they're argumentative, you know, they don't want to go along with anything you have to say, antagonistic, you know, that could be a sign of something. Not necessarily dementia, but that something is going on.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for that call, Linda. I appreciate that. And let's go next to Richard in Manitowoc. Hi, Richard.
Hi. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Or good evening. I forget if it's afternoon or evening right now.
Kind of halfway between right now.
Halfway. No wonder. I'm 81 years old, and my son was here today, and I wanted him to put names on the air crews. I flew in the Navy, bomber crew. And we had, let's see, one, two, three, four. We had seven guys on a crew. So I wanted to see if I could put names on those crew members, even my own crew member, my own crew. And there were a lot of those names I couldn't bring back anymore. And that's from the Korean War. Is that normal not to be able to remember everybody's names anymore?
All right, that's a good question, Richard. Thank you so much for bringing that up. And I think that's something a lot of people have, you know, trouble remembering names. But is that, Carrie, something to be concerned about?
Yeah, many people often experience problem with finding the correct word or a family member. Certainly someone, if you haven't had to place their name in conversation in quite some time, that can definitely be a real challenge for many individuals. And as we know, our body ages and things don't work quite as quickly as they once did with this disease. And so have you been able to find out the information of those other crew members?
Well,
have you thought of it now?
I had the information in my head. We had 11 bombers with seven guys on a crew each one, so I suppose I can't remember them all. But
yeah, you can. It sounds like
I can remember some of them.
Crew
members and stuff like that.
And I guess, Carrie, I mean, this is a long time ago. This is the Korean
right.
War. Is this
right.
Is this something to worry about, or is this is a lot of years in between then and now?
Yeah, you know, I would just really want to know if there's other things that you're noticing with your memory. Have there been any other interruptions or things that you're having to take more time on, whether it's balancing your checkbook? You know, maybe that used to be an hour-long process of reconciling your bills and statements, and maybe it's taking a little bit more time to solve some of those more complicated tasks. Do you have problems with other family members' names or right word in conversation?
Phone numbers. Sure. I have about 30 phone numbers that I ordinarily use, and now I can't remember them all anymore.
Right. You know, some good strategies when you are having some of those mental lapses is make sure you have a backup plan, whether that's writing down some of your common phone numbers. You know, sometimes we let technology make us a little mentally lazy. You know, we can just find a contact name in our phone and just hit a button. Where I know when I grew up, I actually had to punch in the different numbers to our friends and family. And there's some family members I talk to all the time that I don't even know their phone number anymore. So it's up to us to make sure that we're really using what we have for our brain and making sure that it's, you know, kind of the use it or lose it mentality. We need to really task ourselves with some activities to keep that stimulation. So it's great that you're looking through those old war photos, reminiscing about some of those activities. That's all wonderful to do. But until there's maybe one or two other issues, it could just be something that you haven't had to extract in your memory in quite some time.
Well, Richard, I wish you all the best. Thank you so much for calling. And everyone who called, you can also keep the conversation going on the Central Time Facebook page. And Carrie and Kathleen, I want to thank you both so much. Carrie, thanks for joining us.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And if I could just add, you know, we're here for the Alzheimer's Association 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on ALZ.org, which is our website. That's
excellent.
ALZ as in zebra. And we also have social workers and nurses available to take the simplest question about this disease or even the most difficult, challenging situation.
And we're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time. Kathleen, I want to thank you as well. Thank you. You can call the Alzheimer's Association, 800-272-3900. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, results are in from yesterday's primaries for fall elections around the country. We check those out with our weekly congressional expert.
First, it's been a rough week for General Motors. Yesterday, the company announced the recall of nearly 2.5 million vehicles worldwide, and just today announced an additional recall of more than 200,000 other vehicles.
That brings GM's estimated recall total to more than 13 million cars this year in the United States. That breaks the previous annual record of 10.75 million cars in 2004. So where does General Motors go from here?
Here to give us an update on some of the latest recall news is Jesse Toprak, chief analyst at Cars.com. Jesse, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with today's news. We've got another 218,000 recalled cars. Tell us about the model affected and what the problem is.
Well, today's news are affecting the Chevrolet Cobalt. And this is actually going to go back to about 2004 models, and it's going to bring the total up to about over 3 million vehicles. What we're seeing right now is GM is really trying to get all these issues out of the way, it appears, and hope to start the next year with a clean slate after working on all these accumulated potential issues.
Yesterday, we also had the news that there were 2.4 million GM cars being recalled. And this is a lot in a couple of days. Can you give us a sense about what's happening at GM? Why are these recalls coming so fast on one another's heels?
Well, just to put the numbers in perspective, GM recalled over 13.6 million vehicles since February. And that number is about the five times the number that they've sold in the U.S. in the last 5 years. So it's certainly a staggering number. What's happening right now, I believe, is that certainly there have been a lot of quality control issues that's evident by the numbers. But what the company is trying to do is head issues head on, take responsibility, and basically tackle all the potential remaining problems as soon as possible, so that they can move on from this, you know, a bit of a mess of the recall and move from the negative press that's created by the recalls. So this is it's a mad rush, so to speak, to tackle any potential issues that might come about, so that you're going to see them being a lot more proactive. It's going to look pretty bad for this year, but the hope is that this will be mostly handled with a more clean slate for the manufacturer for the following years.
So you're basically saying that GM is trying to really mind its P's and Q's to run a tight ship and to get out ahead of whatever bad news could be coming down the pike, because they can't really afford any more bad news.
No, because this is as bad as it gets in terms of the numbers. It's also costly, too. Actually, the cost of the recalls for them in the first quarter, they took $1.3 billion in loss, and they're expected to take another $400 million in loss. Just the cost of repairs of the recalls in the second quarter. So there is the immediate cost of the actual repairs, and there is the long-term, perhaps more costly portion of the negativity created by the recalls. So there's certainly a year that GM will want to forget.
Now, GM had been a success story of sorts. It had come back from the brink of bankruptcy. What is this going to do to that narrative?
You know, it's interesting because we try to always look at what happens with the recalls and its impact on the marketplace. And so far, there has been very little sales impact of the actual recalls. In fact, GM sales are up about 7% this year, and the stock price has not been affected much at all. And I think the thinking is that, hey, if the company is now handling the issues, what matters for the consumers today and into the future is what the car's quality going to be from this point on, not what happened in the past. And that's how the stock market looks at it too, evidently. So I think, you know, the good news is that there has not been a big hit. And also a lot of the models that were affected, except for a few models, were older models, not the new models that they're selling, hence the limited impact on sales. So when you look at the overall improvement of GM, it's actually a much, much better company than it was just 5 years ago or 10 years ago. The product portfolio they have is the best they've ever had. It's unfortunate that they have to deal with these issues now, but this is not a set of problems that GM can't handle, and they're doing the right thing by being proactive at the moment.
And so if you're a consumer and you're looking to buy a GM vehicle right now, are you thinking, you know, this is in the past, these are older vehicles that are being affected, and basically, you know, GM has to be on top of it right now. Maybe their quality control is even better than other manufacturers. So if you're buying a car now, maybe it doesn't matter.
That's true. So there are two different groups of consumers when it comes to the impact of recalls. One is the loyal customers that are going to buy GMs and or customers that were inclined to buy GM brands, and that's exactly what we hear as a feedback, that they probably are better now than they were before. The only negative impact we've seen is for the group of consumers that are undecided. These are completely undecided consumers that have no brand loyalty. When they're looking at and researching cars online, which as most of us do now nowadays, they may simply take GM vehicles out of their consideration list based on the negative news. So that's the one negative aspect that they may that impact GM, but we haven't really seen that show up itself too dramatically in the sales number so far.
The whole thing has been pretty humiliating, it seems like, for GM until this point. CEO Mary Barra has been scolded publicly by Congress as well, and had to, you know, put on her best face and talk about how GM going forward would certainly improve its image and its quality controls. How is that going over at the executive level at GM?
Well, it's a tough proposition, a tough position for Barra to be in, because clearly she could not have possibly known every single defect, and there's, you know, hundreds of engineers, many suppliers. An average car has got, you know, over 10,000 parts that comes from different places. Clearly, someone needs to answer. And as you, when you're head of a company, that's kind of your role, like it or not. But it's also a bit unfair to put everything on her or the exec team now. These issues have been brewing over the last decade. And clearly, there were mistakes made in the process over the years. I think, you know, the initial response from Barra perhaps has not been perfect in terms of owning up to the issues. But I believe the tone right now is right. It's about owning the issues, fixing the issues, and moving on with much better quality and just the cars that people want to buy.
And going forward from here, what does GM need to do to establish itself or reestablish itself as a solid car company?
Well, step one is to take care of the outstanding issues, handle all the outstanding recalls swiftly, take care of the customers when they come to dealerships, and just the relationship with the clients, with whoever shows up, has to be very positive. It's also interesting that having been at the dealership end a long time ago, these recalls can be good sales opportunities for dealerships, because when you go to a dealership, you might end up buying something else. You just never know. But going forward, it's all about really making the cars that people want to buy. It's that simple. When you do that, though, you also need to keep your eye on quality. Right now, the quality and safety of the vehicles can be detrimental to sales, as we've seen in the past. And it's a matter of combining the style, value, with safety, and marketing it properly. It's a simple formula, but it's tough to pull off. Overall, though, I would say GM's prospects are positive. Their presence in the U.S. is strong. Their market share has grown a bit. They also have a lot to expect in terms of growth from markets like China in the next several years.
Great. Well, Jesse, thank you so much for catching us up and joining us today.
My pleasure.
That was Jesse Toprak, chief analyst at Cars.com. He joined us to talk about the latest GM recalls.
It's time for a weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. Well, establishment Republicans came away with a strong win in yesterday's congressional primaries, beating Tea Party challengers like those who threatened longstanding members of Congress in the last few election cycles.
And after meeting with the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, President Obama spoke to the public today about reports that 40 veterans died while waiting for care at the Phoenix VA hospital. Meanwhile, Congress is considering legislation that would make it easier to fire VA officials.
Paul Singer joins us each Wednesday at this time. Paul, welcome back.
Thanks a lot. Good to be with you, Rob.
Well, the reports seem pretty consistent, calling yesterday's primaries a big victory for the Republican establishment, mainstream Republicans, whatever you want to call them, over activists from the right. Is this just a blip for the Tea Party, or is the tide turning here?
You know, it's hard to tell. They had a couple of races here that early in the cycle looked like they were going to be really barn burners, and they just didn't pan out that way. Most of them actually faded out several weeks ago. I think the real billboard race here was Senator Mitch McConnell, the Senate minority leader. Excuse me, he would like to be the majority leader. Senate minority leader. He was running against a Tea Party challenger named Matt Bevin, who was well funded. He was a wealthy man, so he was spending his own money. And there was a thought several months ago that that could really be tough for McConnell, because McConnell signed the fiscal cliff deal with Obama. He was seen as, in some Tea Party circles, as selling out to end the government shutdown. But none of it stuck, and then ultimately Bevin was not able to get traction, and last night McConnell crushed him. I mean, it was like 30-point margin or something like that.
And this story, similar stories were told in other races around the country. Are mainstream establishment Republicans learning things from 2010, 2012?
Yeah, I think that's a really smart observation. That's right. It's what's happening. Orrin Hatch, several years ago, had a race coming up like this. And Orrin Hatch had been in the Senate for, about 1,000 years. And it was 2 years to go. He dove into his state from Utah. He went back and he spent significant time in the state. He made friends. He spent a lot of money. He was on the ground all the time, and he got his face in front of people. So they remembered he was there, and they remembered that he mattered. And it really put out a playbook for these guys. A lot of them are now taking the same basic playbook, which is engage, 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 and spend a lot of money early. Don't get caught by surprise. I think you'll see the alternative is in Kansas, where Senator Pat Roberts is fighting claims that he basically doesn't even live in his state. And in a place where he should be easily reelected, he's going to have trouble in his primary because he can't prove that he's been there.
And I've seen some response from national Tea Party organizations saying, yeah, our candidates didn't win, but we've been successful because we're making those incumbents run to the right and commit themselves to policies closer to our liking.
Well, that is a very interesting point. It is a double-edged sword. That may very well be correct. What they are saying is, yeah, our candidate lost, but our issues won, because in order to win, the candidate had to stand closer where we stand on the issues. Now, of course, the Democrats are saying the exact same thing, which is, yeah, in order to win, these Republican, sort of mainstream Republicans, have had to be much more conservative, and therefore that's going to be good for the Democrats, because now they're going to have to run back to the center from where they were during their primaries, and that'll be a challenge for them.
We mentioned, of course, Mitch McConnell. What were a couple of the other big Tea Party versus establishment Republican primaries you were watching?
Well, one of the interesting ones was in Georgia. Georgia is a state where the Democrats have a nominee they like, Michelle Nunn, who's the daughter of former Senator Sam Nunn. And they were sort of, Democrats were excited because some of the candidates in that race were very conservative and in some ways a little offbeat that could have been alienating to a general election electorate. Ultimately, there was one candidate down there we were very interested in named Hendel. She was the choice of Sarah Palin. Mm-hmm. Karen Hendel. Sarah Palin had endorsed her, and that really boosted her campaign all of a sudden, but she came up short in the primary, and now it's going to be a runoff between two guys who are really sort of GOP establishment guys, Congressman Kingston and a businessman named David Perdue. So that was a race we were watching because we wanted to see whether Sarah Palin could push somebody over the hump down there. Also worth watching was in Oregon. This is a race the Democrats should be able to win, but it looks like it could be a bit of a challenge for them. And it featured these candidates, Monica Wiebe, who had been endorsed by Mitt Romney, versus this guy Jason Conger, who had been endorsed by Rick Santorum. So in some ways it was a replay of the 2012 Republican primaries, and the Romney Republican won, and the Santorum Republican lost in that primary.
Now, Georgia and Kentucky are two states where the Democrats are hoping to play offense, maybe take away a seat from Republicans. Most of the story of this election is in the other direction.
Right.
Democrats worried that they are not going up against candidates who are likely to shoot themselves in the foot.
Right. Well, that, to some degree, is the outcome of these races, is the Democrats didn't get the candidates they wanted. There is some suspicion that the Democrats have been behind a bunch of leaks out in Oregon that were designed to make Monica Wiebe look like, you know, a woman who was crazy, basically. She was, accused of trespassing and harassment of an old boyfriend some years ago. And the Democrats were sort of circulating this stuff, apparently in an attempt to get a better candidate to run against, somebody who would be seen as a little more outside the mainstream. So, yeah, I mean, it may be now the Democrats are facing the candidates they don't want because they didn't get the candidates who they can paint as real radicals.
Before we move on from elections, what are the next couple primaries you are keeping your eye on?
You know, I knew you were going to ask that question. I'm just at the moment trying to remember this. I know June 3rd there are a couple of primaries that we're interested in. There will be, I think there's an Alabama primary that may be mildly interesting. Iowa, that's the one, I apologize, right, it's the Iowa one, where, again, Democrats had a good candidate, have a good candidate, and are excited about their candidate, but he's stepped in it a couple of times in the past few weeks, and now the Republicans think they have a nice opportunity, and there's a woman named Jody Ernst who's been endorsed again by Sarah Palin, and the question is whether she can take over that race in Iowa. That'll be June 3rd.
We'll be watching those in future shows. Well, moving on to other news this morning, President Obama spoke to the public about these allegations we've been hearing about misconduct, cover-ups at a VA facility, a hospital in Phoenix. So let's listen to a clip of the president.
Any misconduct, whether it's allegations of VA staff covering up long wait times or cooking the books, I will not stand for it. If these allegations prove to be true, it is dishonorable, it is disgraceful, and I will not tolerate it, period. First, anybody found to have manipulated or falsified records at VA facilities has to be held accountable.
That's the president's response. What are we hearing from Congress about this VA ongoing scandal?
Well, this is going to be an issue. I mean, I think this is one of those scandals that people can really understand and can really appreciate. It is fairly simple. It is catastrophically bad management at a large bureaucratic government agency that may have led to the deaths of veterans who are not getting the care they deserved. That is something that Obama is going to have to spend a lot of time explaining. And one of the things you're hearing from Congress today is that he didn't say anything. He didn't announce anything. All he said basically is we will spend the next few weeks looking at it, and when we figure out who did something wrong, heads are going to roll. But he didn't launch any new initiative. He didn't fire General Shinseki, who's the veteran secretary. There has been some call for him to be fired. In fact, interestingly enough, one of the endangered Democratic members of Congress, who's in a tough re-election race, today called for Shinseki to be fired. So you're going to get a lot of reaction from Congress being, A, we need to know more, we need to know more, we need to know more, and then B, from the Republicans, obviously, you'll see, how come Obama's just discovering this? Where has he been the past 6 years when there has been a lot of reports of backlogs and poor service at VA hospitals?
Well, is any of this outrage being channeled into the form of legislation?
Well, there is a bill kicking around on the House floor, and honestly, they have not yet checked today whether it was supposed to pass today, I think, a bill that would essentially make it easier to punish or fire VA officials who may be responsible for some of this wrongdoing. It's a small step, but I think it's really more than anything else an opportunity for Congress to express its outrage. I think the bigger issue is how do you fix this problem? I mean, and then Obama was making this point during his presentation today that, you know, there are a lot of veterans who are aging now. The baby boomers are aging. They are becoming more dependent on services. We have, you know, a million people coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq who are in need of care. And the lists of people needing services at the VA are increasing. And punishing and firing people at the VA is a great thing, but that doesn't necessarily solve the problem. How do we get care to this large and growing larger pool of people who need the care?
We had the commander. We had the national commander of the American Legion on this week. In addition to calling for resignations and changes, he said, "Hey, Congress needs to provide more funding for these facilities to lower these waiting lists." In our last little bit here, is anybody talking about that?
Yeah, people will talk about it, but again, you know, the problem with funding in every case is, A, where does the money come from, and B, what good does the money do? I mean, if you're just throwing money at a program that's broken, it doesn't necessarily do you any good. It's an easy solution. It's like, oh, we'll give them an extra, you know, a couple billion dollars. But something else will have to be cut to make up for that. And you still have to figure out how they're spending that $1 billion to make sure that it is doing something good. And what it needs to do is to cut wait times and provide services to veterans.
We'll wrap up there. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Rob. Have a great week.
That was Paul Singer, politics editor at USA Today. We check in on the doings in Congress each Wednesday at this time.